sticks can be adhered to if we adhere to them, and they could be beneficial to us in holding our consciousness up as a human being. Now, the marriage life is not a type of life that in the fairy books. Prince Charming don't exist, and Princess Snow White don't exist, and living happily ever after don't exist. These are imaginary suppositions of printed letters. What does exist is a human being, a male, who is designed by certain specific forces to deposit or to go out in constant flow. The urge to drive or reach out, to penetrate, to challenge. What does exist in a female body is the nesting force, the gathering, the collecting action. Then these two forces are in direct opposition in their perfectness, but at the same time, they are uniquely blended when they learn to merge. And the merging is a process. It's not an overnight thing of living happily ever after. It's the process of trying how to live together happily after the commitment between each other is made at the altar. That is the process, learning how to live happily after the marriage contract or the marriage vow. This is where the Prince Charming and the princess activity comes in, because the perennial courtship should not cease. Marriage is just as much 24-hour activity, or just as much going to work for somebody, and you know you're under the gun, because it is that particular process. It's not something that we can take for granted. We can't take human beings for granted, not even how close or intimate we are, because familiarity breeds contempt. The cells themselves, from being too over familiar, turn off their wavelength of feeling for one another. And this is a peculiar sensation. The one that you may be intimate with, after a while, touching them seems to turn you off. And touching someone else seems to turn you on. That is because of the over-familiarity with the individual. But the continual pursuit, the continual romance, the reaching out, it's the subtle strangeness, that guru-disciple relationship, that slight point between you and God, not 200% intimate with Him yet, a little sense of respect, this little tinge is sufficient to keep the balance of the love going. So we do need to realize that in the olden days that the men lived in one room and the wife lived in another room, and they built up this particular courtship constantly. Now you look in the animal kingdom, the courtship never ends, especially those who are mated for life. This is a phenomenon that man has not begun to recognize. The eagle is the only bird that flies the highest, but mates for life. Yet the eagle never takes for granted the mate. When the time comes, when his own body cycles, the male eagle, he goes through the pruning and doing all the eagle dance. Even though he's mated, he will still go through the eagle dance. And the female eagle, she will do the same thing. And this is constantly going on between them. That's why in the animal kingdom or in the bird kingdom, the plumage and their cycle periods are beautiful. This phenomena is in man because man has a cycle period. And once he understands the cycle periods, he can keep that continuity and that contact or flow between the male and the female. You wanted to say something?
Just curious about miscarriage.
We haven't come to that yet. The important thing now is the discharge. We haven't come to that yet. We must understand why you're discharging. Why is it that you seek to stimulate yourself to discharge yourself? Because these are conditions of biological forces locked up in us, straining to go out. And our society is not designed for human beings to live. We don't have schools of what is called training yourself to get married or training yourself to be pregnant. There are no such schools. When you're married, you're pregnant. And if you aren't married and you're pregnant, that's a problem. Society looks down upon all these things. There is no such thing. You can't have a school to train somebody to be pregnant. Because it's not the accepted thing. If you're pregnant, you're pregnant. And who is the first ostracism? Who is the parent? Who is the donor? Who is the father? These are the things you are going to be faced with in a society like ours. Now, in certain societies, like in the primitive societies, before the men and the women got together, they had what is called the 1 year break the taboo. Before the marriage was accepted between the parents, they had what is called the taboo between the boy and the girl, that they shouldn't touch each other. Then when it's accepted, then they have what is called a year adjustment. They spend that time learning to adjust to each other for a year, learning to know each other for a year. Now, he learns about his organs and she learns about her organs. Then they have a ritual when the wedding comes on to indicate if the girl is chaste or not. Well, in the islands, they do like this. The man may say, my daughter is a chaste girl, and she will take the 1 year adjustment period. On the day of the wedding, he will butcher a suckling pig and put a fruit in the mouth and give it to the bridegroom, symbolically saying the daughter has been chaste during the adjustment period of the year. All right. The bridegroom takes the bride home. If she is chaste, he returns the suckling pig with the apple or fruit in the mouth, untouched. If she is not, he bites a portion out of it and sends it back with the girl. Then the father is deeply ostracized in the public because he has brought up an unchaste daughter. See, taboos are existing. Why they exist? Because these primitive people can see the auras and they can see what would happen. Now, also in primitive tribes, you have only the royalty marry into royalty to have the starting of the nation, of a new bloodline. In the Hawaiian group, you have that. If a Hawaiian group, say a prince or a princess, is the last descendant of the parent, and some cataclysm has come and driven them out, they'll go away to another area and start the royalty line. She will marry into her bloodline, and they'll have one child, and that one child is called the Alui Nui. He is blessed, or she is blessed, with the force. Sometimes it comes out that that child is a beautiful person, or it may come out deformed. Now, but after that has occurred, they don't have no more like that. They do marry into some other bloodline. But that Alui Nui is the one that carries the force and is a descendant of that royalty. So you find your Hawaiian princes are all the result of inbreeding. This was a way man would keep his bloodline. Now, in your scriptures, they were warned against incest. Incest is not a new idea, it was a condition that existed to set up bloodlines among royalty. But then it lost its peculiar genetic function just as much as in animals, you see. Now, changing the bloodlines was a challenge because it might bring in polluted lines into it. So they had to be very selective into their bloodlines. Man was also following exactly that same principle. Now, all these conditions led to karmic tendencies. When kings and queens, or royalty in any form, or aristocrats in any form, or who could not afford to be burdened down with children, then began to resort to abortive methods. They began to resort to contraceptive methods just because they could not allow the royalty to go out and be a threat to each other in the ownership of the throne or the kingdom. Now, the rich in ancient time were the ones who aborted first. They're the ones who indulge in the contraceptives. The poor never thought of it or did it. They simply accepted their lot and had their children and tried to provide for it, even they died from starvation. The more sophisticated the man or the woman became, and the higher on the economical totem pole he was, the more experimentation became. Now, he experimented now outside of the marriage cycle, thus producing the condition of mental imbalances. A man may be married. He may be a wealthy man. He's committed to his wife. But he sees a beautiful woman, but he can't do anything. And he dies with the thought of that person. In the next incarnation, he's thrown into confrontation with that person to have an affair or an experience with her. The Lord has to work these things out. Sometimes we say to ourselves, by gosh, why did I ever meet you? And now I am married. It's only to realize, well, karmic conditions throw us together. But then there is the challenge, and there is the lust, and there is the self-control that is putting us together to relate. If we understand it, then we rise above it. If we don't understand it, then we succumb to it. Then if we look back, sometimes our parents, somewhere along the line, might have similar tendencies. They might have succumbed, they might not have succumbed, they might want to succumb. And this is very strong in their mechanism, and we carry a part of that in our tendency, in ourselves, and we are drawn into the experience. Contraceptives is a form also of aborting the energy. Now, I said within the marriage cycle, you have the freedom. If you use the contraceptive in the marriage cycle between the marriage couple, this is your freedom to up to a certain extent, just as much as the release and the discharge of the energy without bringing it to completion is within your own freedom. But then you have a price to pay of a constant wastage and a constant blockage, because the formation of the brain and the spinal cord, we are constantly discharging brain cells. And the brain cells are carrying the thought patterns, and in the atmosphere, these entities are hanging around and are waiting for the opportunity when the forces get together and complete themselves. So you see, even in an abortion, we are doing exactly the same thing by discharging the energy without bringing it to completion. That entity is still hanging around, waiting for another opportunity. Now, in a miscarriage, this is a different thing now. You don't deliberately cause a miscarriage in yourself. A miscarriage can be caused by shock, a fall, or several other activities which are karmic to a certain extent, but are not triggered by you deliberately to discharge the energy in such a way that it will prevent it from coming to completion. You might have done in a previous life an act of aborting one life, and now you're forced to live through a miscarriage in the present life. Or you might have aborted and forced to live through death in pregnancy in the present life. You see, someone could have a miscarriage, and it might be that individual who did not come to completion in a previous life and now has come to completion in this life and is married and is pregnant, and before the baby can be born, there is a complication. And in the society that is being born, the complication becomes intense, and they have to make a choice between the parent and the child. So they save the child and let the parent die. In the frontier days, the Sawbones, that was the name of your doctors, you know, the Sawbone. He wasn't a real doctor then. They actually would try to save the baby and let the mother die. And this became a conflict of philosophy at one time between the medical profession, which was wiser to save the newborn child or the parent. Now, in some groups of medical field thinking, they say to save the mother and let the child go would be beneficial for the sake of the husband, who has to carry on with the mate, that can always have another child. But the mate could be a tremendous shock of loss, and to the children that they may have, and the need for a balance of stability in the family. That's one school of thought. Another school of thought is, let the mother die and save the child, because it's a new entity in the world and would have a greater chance for survival. And since there are more adults around unmarried and need a chance to try their hand at marriage or parenthood, this would be ideal for the remaining partner. So you have men devising his own techniques of survival at the expense of his fellow men. And it's all locked up again now back to the birth process. So sanitation has come in now to place the balance in trying to bring about the reproductive condition without creating too much stress on the individual, like the husband that is going to remain a widow. Because of sanitation and hospitalization techniques, the husband is no longer remaining a widow. with a bunch of crying children and have to look for someone to take care or relate to now. The child is gone. It's a lesser shock, but the wife is still there. Instead of a greater shock of the loss of the wife and having the children to care for. So these two schools of philosophy exist, but the diminishing effect is that the doctors try to save the parent more than the baby. They have come to realize which is the lessening shock of the two evil conditions, or which of the two have a damaging effect on the husband. Some schools of thought say that when you perform abortion or you perform contraceptives, you are not really taking life. But essentially, what are you really doing? You are releasing certain life forms that are triggered off from brain cells. And these life forms have an electrical wave, an electrical entity body, which carry the desire nature of the individual. That cannot be destroyed. This is where the saint or the master or religious people come in now to emphasize why in your scriptures there are certain references to these ideas of spilling the seed or aborting before completion, and why a pope would be adamant against trying to accept these ideas of birth control or abortion. They are looking at a deeper aspect of the structure of men, and they're looking at the illnesses that will follow in the progeny of men, more so than the mere satisfaction of his pleasure and his physical nature at the present state of his need in his environment, and the fear of the politician of overpopulation and undernourishment and lack of education. Man will never be in a state of lack of education. He will never reach the state of total overpopulation, and he will never reach the state where he is destroy himself. Yes?
Might this be part of the way we prohibit these things? About, first of all, birth control. Secondly, if it causes sicknesses that we don't know anything about or problems, then it will continue to lower the population and fight that situation. I mean, can't this be just as natural a solution to the situation as we're natural and we form these chemicals and we make them, and the whole bit works in together? This may be part of the whole plan. Is that a possibility?
We have to take the words of masters who have looked at the whole cosmic consciousness and see what is behind it, why it's not working out that way, and why the ego and the mind would want it to work that way in order to satisfy the type of desires that are generated by the mind and the senses. The mind is involved in the pursuit of pleasure, in the pursuit of sensory stimulation, in the acquisition of material objects, in the release of pent-up emotions at the expense of others, and finally, to attain that particular degree of recognition without effort. The mind is in pursuit of that all the time. Now, the mind is not interested if you are hurt to generate compassion, unless it threatens the individual to some extent. The mind is not concerned with your agony unless it threatens you in your pursuit of pleasure, that it would cause you some slight of discomfort or agony. The mind is not concerned with people being dominated as long as you aren't threatened, and as long as you are profiting from the domination, the mind will not be concerned. This is how the mind works. It does not deprive itself. The only time it will ever seek to react or resent any threat to it is when it's going to lose its own level or status. Then it's going to worry. But outside of that, the mind will pursue the satisfaction of its sensory nature first. It will do exactly what the brain will do. The brain will deprive the whole body of all the nutrients to stay alive longer than the rest. Every doctor knows that. Your brain will deprive any part of your body of its nutrients to stay alive longer. So if your brain is going to do that organically alone, then the mind follows suit. Survival. Yes. It's true in pregnancy. Because if the brain is threatened at any time, it'll kill the it'll cut off the supply to the fetus. The brain cannot allow the conscious body function to dominate the survival nature of it. It's designed with this power granted to the survival nature of the mechanism to be in total relentless control of it. Your subjective mind is a merciless dictator. It has no friends. It only knows one friend. That's itself. It's like that main switch in your house. It has no respect for your refrigerator if you pull it off, or your food inside the refrigerator, or the power in the house. Once you pull that main switch, everything is cut. Equally true, the subjective mind is like that. And that part is in the lower part of the brain, the back part of the brain. It's in the cerebellum, in this area of the brain, the back part. And the cerebrum, which is the motivating part or conscious active part in directing yourself and giving you the feeling that you're in control, always making decisions to change the environment. This is only temporary. This is an elusive part. It's not genuine because it really doesn't control. When survival sets in, or anything that would threaten the survival, they begin to see who is the real boss. The conscious mind finds out pretty fast that he is no boss at all. He's merely a good spokesman, but a lousy carry through. He can't carry it through because his subconscious mind will not allow him. Your heart that pumps the blood from that portion of the brain that regulates it is not going to allow your physical mechanism to interfere with the pumping of the heart. Now, the yogis who can consciously slow down their heart can't slow it down if they are unethical. They can't slow it down without some degree of practice and right attitude. Even they come to the basic mechanics of yoga and breathing, they got to understand the right attitude, or else they will put themselves in a state of cataleptic action or permanently damage their organs. And so the yogi don't play around with his mechanism, even though he knows he can consciously assume the control from the subconscious realm over the body, he has to obey the rules. The first rule of yoga is called the do's and don'ts, the yamas and the niyamas, the things you can do, the things you cannot do on a conscious level that will allow you to get the control from the subjective level. So your brain is doing this. Your brain is designed in two parts, one to let you pursue the pleasure of the five senses, and the other part is to maintain the stability of your existence. Now, in the pursuit of your five senses, we can build up a host of false philosophies or false ideas about ourselves and continue to live like it or with them, only to find out that we played out on a string by the subconscious mind. There's a saying, they say, give him enough rope, he'll hang himself. The subconscious mind will let you play the game of pleasurable pursuit until you find out that you really didn't get nothing out of the pleasure. You got an empty balloon because your senses can't take the strain, the heart can't take the strain, the lungs can't take the strain, the vital organs can't take the strain, and they will shut off automatically by command from the subconscious mind, because the subconscious mind is not going to allow itself to be dominated by the conscious mind. You see, the subconscious mind dominates the conscious mind in terms of survival, not in terms of mere behavior of how we act to one another. But when it comes to how these organs must survive, how they must function from inside, then the subconscious mind is a relentless individual. He has no friends.
Then this accounts for the various reactions that happen to someone when they are directly threatened with a life-death situation. So you really cannot predict what you will do.
Right. See, you can have a set of circumstances or conditions around you in which your conscious mind may figure out or would like to do, but when it comes to the actual doing, the putting yourself into the actual mechanical action of it, your subconscious mind will take precedent over, because that which is best for its survival. So you see, your brain would take away from those portions of the body all the nutrients that are necessary for its own personal survival. And that's the cerebellum that would do that. Yeah.
We're more in contact with our subconscious when we meditate, is that right?
Yes, you're more in contact with your subconscious when you meditate, because you're trying to feel how the survival structure of your mechanism would function. You see, we don't know how to trust our survival nature. We look to God as an invisible force and try to trust in Him, not realizing that that invisible force is our survival nature, which made it possible for the sperm to become the ovum, the two blending and one and becoming a human being. When that one sperm moved on its own survival rate and blended with the ovum and became a human being, that was all subjective. Daddy had no way in his own mental frame of reference consciously to say which one of the sperms are going to get up there. Do you see? Our father cannot. Even you as a human being cannot say which sperm has to get up there or which ovum got to get up there to make contact. There is no way on a conscious level that the male body or the female body is going to determine how these two forces are going to meet. The subconscious level determines that. And the subconscious level is like the main switch. It's the power drive. It's the survival power. When it determines which one succeeds, then it entrusts that finished product with a momentum or a force to which it has an alliance with or a commitment with, that it will nourish it all through its existence if it would listen to it. But it will tolerate, up to a certain point, a false excuse of behavior from a conscious level and let the physical mechanism believe in an illusion that is regulating. So the five senses get inflated from the conscious level and believe that it's regulating, it's correcting the environment, it's doing everything. Without me, it can go. This illusion is tolerated by the subconscious mind up to a certain point. That point is called the survival frequency, which would be the most important decision or act to do when threatened. When a vital organ is threatened, or some part of your mechanism is threatened from the conscious realm by some other conscious operator or agent, we will find out that superconsciousness and subconsciousness jump in and take over and make sure that you don't goof. See? So it is your subconscious mind that is dominating you from inside. And we have to learn to rely on it. So meditation is to help us to listen and get back in and sense it. So the brain normally would do that. Take what it needs from the other body parts at their expense for its own survival.
What level of the mind does this react as we have the stress condition to release the sexual subconscious mind?
The subconscious mind does not have no craving for sex release. There's no craving in the subconscious mind for sex release. Sex release is in the conscious mind because of stimulation from the outer realm. The male body is stimulated by sight. The female body is stimulated by sound. These are external conditions. These are external drives. And the only thing that is internal is the suppressed emotion or the deprivation of contact, tactual contact to release, or this concentrated residues of food that are not properly ingested and are throwing off toxins into the system. These are unconscious levels. The subconscious mind would go along, allowing the conscious mind to take active control. But really, the subconscious mind does not have anything to do with a sex drive. That's why they say pain and sex are opinions of the mind.
Well, where does the mind go in pain when you're unconscious?
There is no, it doesn't go no way, it just, the pain has certain degrees of intensity. It's electrical frequency like music or rates or tones. And when it hits the nerves, at that particular vibratory rate, the nerve will register on the brain certain intensification. After a certain point of intensification, there is no more pain because the brain would automatically go into a state of shock. Now, how would you know when you're in a state of shock?
How would a person know himself?
You don't feel nothing when you're in shock. You're in a state of apathy. You don't, between shock and cosmic consciousness, the only difference is that in shock, that your heart is not beating as slow as in a state of cosmic consciousness. There's a slight difference in the heartbeat. But as far as the mental relationship is concerned, they're identical. A person in a state of shock is in a state of apathy, but his heart is beating a little faster. A person in cosmic consciousness is tranquil, or what you say, cosmically apathetic, because he doesn't care or have nothing to care for, but he is serenely satisfied that he's alive and enjoying it all. And his heart is slower, but he's not crazy. In other words, he can accept his apathy whereas shock, you can't accept your apathy. A person shocks you, you look at them, and as if to say, is it really happening to me? They tell you something about yourself, and in your mind, you analyze, did I really do these things? Were my actions the outcome of such an evaluation by this individual? I was trying to do my best for this individual. I can only see good in my actions. And now I am hearing that my actions are really detrimental, not to myself, but to other people who were fooled by my actions. Then you are in a state of shock because you can't react. Because there is no way for you to react. You are suddenly told that your actions were very, very cruel actions, but you don't recognize them as cruel actions. When you thought that the actions that you were performing were supposed to be good actions for the benefit of your friend. Then your friend turns around and in his evaluation tells you your actions are cruel, very, very, what do you call it, unscrupulous, or very, very degenerate actions. So right away you're in a shock. It's like waves and you can't do nothing. Semi-paralysis.
And later times, after any period of shock you've had since you're a young child, any time you've ever released the sexual energy since you were born, you at later time have to go back over to release those pent-up emotions of those shocks, paralysis, or is there a lasting effect upon the cellular system?
No, there is no lasting effect. The shock is not a lasting effect. Shock is temporary and sublimates itself.
Then why do you not remember?
You can remember and you do remember, but you refuse to remember because of the pain. You deliberately, consciously want to shut it out because you're afraid to face yourself. You're always trying to kid yourself that you need more time to handle it, that you got enough gumption or know-how from inside, somewhere inside of you, that you can take care of it if you have enough time to do it. And you're always telling yourself that, I need more time, I can do it, I can handle it. I just need more time, the conditions are pressing upon me. If they'll only give me more time, they don't bug me, I'll really shape up, measure up, I'll really handle this situation. So what is really happening is this, you're suffering from biological procrastination to face the results of a shock. And therefore you're crying in your mind for time, which is in action and in essence biological procrastination to face the situation that is in your mind harsh, cruel, painful. But that is what you think in your mind, and therefore you generate this procrastination feeling. But what actually is occurring in the mind is entirely different. What is actually occurring in the mind that there is no pain, but just the sensations of association by the tonal voice, by the gestures of individuals you have to confront. And the procrastination is not real procrastination, but is your ability to handle it is not mature. And you don't want to appear ridiculous by being incapable of handling it at that time when you're called upon to handle it. You see? If you try to handle it when you're called upon to handle it and you don't find yourself fumbling or lacking the savoir-faire of handling it, then you say to yourself, gee, I'm pretty smart, I can handle my problems. Therefore, nothing is really wrong with me. I don't need no guidelines. But because you know deep down that you're not handling it, and the only way for you to feel competent to handle it is to ask for more time, so you set up what is called the procrastination cycle.
And how do you stop that procrastination cycle? When can you get down to basics without, you know, you've got the spirit pain. Every moment of unconsciousness that I have had has been in a time of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And why the spirit, why you say pain does not exist?
It doesn't. Psalm that God protects you and covers you with his feathers. So one day, her husband came home and he was very drunk and he began to beat up her. And she began to shout, feathers, 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 feathers. And he looked at her, he says, what's the matter with you? You've gone crazy? There are no feathers around here. And he was cured. And she was never beaten up no more. Now, what cured him and what saved both of them?
Faith.
No. The repetition of even a 16th of a psalm. If you take one word, and it does not matter if you what it is, and you repeat it, it's the essence of the thing. To take a sound, if it is chalk, or feathers, or God, or teacher, or any name, and just repeat it over and over. The science is in the repetition. The actual scientific principle is in the repetition. It's called japa or simran. Another name for it in English is hallowing. Hallowing. And that repetition, the repeating of it. Now, when you do that, then it works.
Also, about these psalms, if you don't know, for instance, my Bible doesn't indicate, you know, what the psalms are for like that one does. Will the psalm be made known to you if you need it? I mean, if you open your book of psalms, will the right one?
One of these days, which will be, I think, we'll make it a Thanksgiving retreat and dedicate it to the science of the Psalms. The whole scientific that period, we'll make a note of it. For those who want to attend the Thanksgiving retreat, it will be dedicated to the science of the Psalms.
Now, the Thanksgiving retreat is the one psalm we can use now so we can attend it.
Yes, yes, right, okay. Yeah. Right. You see, there's a psalm that you can use to be able to attend the retreat. It's right there. It's called the Psalm of Journey. The Psalm of Journey, I think, is the 104th psalm. You use that for traveling.
Which name goes with that
one? Oh, that is Adonai. The 104th psalm. So. So, the psalms themselves are powerful forces. But we're coming back again to the male-female body now. The ancient men knew that they could correct many of the malfunctions by sound waves, and that we did not have to resort to abortion or contraceptives or anything, that these psalms would correct these situations. Now remember, when the Christ child was being born, labor pain existed in the mother. But by the right psalms, she came through a painless childbirth, natural childbirth. She gave birth to her own child. There were no doctors around, you know, to perform or midwives to perform the delivery of Jesus. because certainly Joseph didn't have hot water.
He did what?
He didn't have any hot water. You can't have a delivery without hot water in no way, shape, or form. You ever see any natural childbirth in the old-fashioned pioneer days perform without hot water?
Just to get him away.
Okay. So, there were only animals around and just Mary and Joseph. But she had natural childbirth, and the delivery was brought on by the Psalms. Mantra again. They are the Psalms for childbirth and delivery. So, there again we go back to the human body, understanding it. Once we understand that this body, these forces are corrected by sound waves, then we can also build up the sound waves in the body so that the body will not fall short of its behavior, because the whole structure of the universe is based on sound. Now, decuration of the cells, the major cause is sound. See that sound? It's being sustained on your cells, and your cells have a tolerance point. After a certain level, they'll start breaking down. So you will suffer from the peculiar phenomenon known as air conditional degeneration of the cells. The sound itself is causing a sonic disintegration. So there was a man who wrote a book called America, the Air Conditioned Nightmare. Sound can build, sound can break down. And the walls of Jericho stood up after they blew their horns. You remember that one?
If you were upside down, they might have looked like
oh, okay. So he stood on his nose. Now, let us come back to few more of the, we're dealing with the, again with the male-female body, continuing with the discharge and the contraceptive methods. They do leave entities in the atmosphere that are not consummated or completed and have to come back in some form to release themselves. Now, Master Yukteswar said, biting insects, stinging insects, or creatures are the result of the negative thought forces precipitating in the atmosphere into these forms. And they are the way how the energy is dissipated out into nature again. Now, if from that particular association that negative forces do end up in the biting, stinging, poisonous objects of our environment, rest assured that the decrepit, deformed, and the malfunctioning of human bodies appearing are also the result of unfinished desire patterns of individuals wasting the vital fluids prior to marriage.
Is it, this is one thing I never understood. Because Bawa was saying a similar thing too, and I never understood him, I never understand you. Is it the parents that cause the birth of a deformed child by their thought patterns, or is it the karma of the child and the parents to be born deformed and to have a deformed child?
The first one.
Isn't that a little bit unjust?
Why?
Because what, you know, what kind of universe is it that the parents would like have the ability to shape, you know, a totally...
Tell it to Adam. and Eve. Tell it to Adam and Eve.
What's the difference between karma and, you know, how can you say, how much is karma, how much is fate? Is it, isn't it
prala, karma, to be born to form? There is no such thing as fate. There is destiny, there is karma, but not fate. Fate is an invention of the human mind. And these are the words of a living master and the words of a dead master. Paramahamsa Yogananda often said there is no fate, there is destiny, and there is karma. The living master will tell you there is no fate. There is the destiny, and there is the karma, but not fate.
So wouldn't it be the destiny karma to be born in a deformed body?
Karma is that law of action. For every action, there is a reaction. And the reaction is predetermined by the desire and must complete itself at some particular destination in time. And you, the recipient, is the cause of it. Therefore, you're destined to have your payment when the time comes due. So that is something you have to face. Now, you're not fitted to face it. It is set by your thought pattern to for it to come due, for it to come to you to be collected. So you are the recipient of it because you triggered it. So there is no injustice in that. This is an equal law of pure justice based upon your personal responsibility to yourself and to your environment. So the law is very just. You can't say it's unjust. It's a just law. What you sow, you reap. You see, you can't plant tomatoes and get corn, or else you'll be all rich people. You can only get the same thing.
But
these unborn entities, they don't have to come back to reach completion in a human form.
Yes, they have to.
Eventually.
Eventually, they have to take on some malformation or some disease in the atmosphere.
Each time there's not completion and there's not a child born, then there's one of these electrical
forms that are there. In the marriage act, the forms are there, you see, but you have the freedom in the marriage act when this form is released. You have also the upliftment of your consciousness to try. Therefore, that is the improvement. But outside of the marriage act, the frequency is still the same, because if the individual does not desire to change the environment or change the attitude to the other individual and respect the other human being, if he doesn't have a respect for the female body and grant or bring about this relationship to put it into a bond of marriage, that entity that is released is not getting a chance to raise its stature. It's not going to recycle itself. It's when they're given the opportunity, the auras blend. There are vital forces that come in there by grace and intercession that corrects that entity field, so that when it enters the new circuitry of body, it is coming in now with a higher degree than it of understanding before. It did not have that. You see? But now that the man or the woman have consented to merge their forces in an alliance of mutual consent with respect. That's why Jesus said, he who accepts me publicly or confesses me publicly, I will confess him to my Father openly, publicly. Means by a mutual consent. If you take on the responsibility to grow as a unit without any secretiveness or guilt reaction, then you have raised that entity level of that individual that has been released prior to marriage, that may have to come back into the body. It's given a chance to be raised now. Before, it didn't have a chance.
It's sex with love and respect, and also the soul purpose of procreation.
Yes. It is this respect for the female body as much as for the male body that brings about the love and the raising of the soul nature. Otherwise, there is no raising. How is it going to raise itself? Now, for instance, let's say the act was performed outside of marriage and the two individuals wanted a master to come in. You think the master will come in? He wouldn't come in. So they performed the act, but then the act didn't come to completion. But deep down in their mind, they would want some high soul to come in, but the high soul doesn't come in. Then all of a sudden they read about the initiate life or the spiritual life, and they decide to change their attitude and try now to be initiate and get married. That mere alteration of attitude and behavior now sets the place and the stage for that very entity that was released inadvertently before by wrong attitude to now lock in and pull down more power. So before you know it, that child is coming into the higher calibration. But you made it possible for that child to have that opportunity. You gave it the opportunity. See?
So there's only one of these entities released each time and not several thousand for each sperm.
Keep using the word released, not created. One.
You're releasing them. Not one, many. It's not one, you're releasing many. When you think of it, you can see why the chances of open population is highly in favor of them. You're saying, Bob? They're already part of the structure of pure energy. There are billions and billions of soul forces locked up, each for every sperm and its multiple form of the sperm. Now, let's say the human body, one mature male, from birth to death, is capable of secreting by the natural mechanics 67 billion sperms in one lifespan of, say, 4.5 pounds of semen. That's the total secretion that the human body will make in one life. 4.5 pounds. And it will generate 4.5 pounds. It doesn't generate more than that. One male body will generate 4.5 pounds. Now, and it'll total about 67 million live sperms, billion sperms. So you got 67 billion on soul forces waiting to enter. You think, think of overpopulation. There's no such thing in the Lord. The Lord, he don't know about overpopulation. He's got a big universe. To him, there's no such thing, but he knows that by the law of average and by the law of causation and the law of karmic responsibility and by the law of the astrological or zodiacal movement, for each individual there will be one entity activating one circuitry or two entities activating two circuitry. It'll be a strange physical body that will have 8 babies. We don't have octuplets yet. So far, we've only come to quintuplets or sextuplets. I haven't heard yet of septuplets. I've heard up to 6, but I've never heard up to 7 yet. It's not impossible that a woman can have 7 babies.
These all existed.
Yeah.
Some plane of consciousness. Our physical action
brings them down.
And they stay just above the physical plane?
Just above the physical plane.
Is this what the Sufis mean when they talk about the
jinns? Yes, the jinns and the Parsis and the various gnomes. They are all existing there. Now, they have the jinn of the blue light and the jinn of the red light, the jinn of the green light, the jinn of the orange light, the jinn of the red light. Every color of the spectrum has a jinn. That's the male genie. You see, masculine jinn, feminine genie. So they're always finding either in a bottle. Because you ever figure out, you don't know who put the genie in the bottle? The man that put the jinn or the genie in the bottle, or all bottles for that, most of the bottles, is Solomon. Solomon, the seal of Solomon is the only seal that cannot be broken by the jinn. See, the jinn. It means it's bonded.
Why did Solomon
seal up?
What did he seal up?
He sealed up a jinn. Solomon was the only mystic or initiate that went as far as sealing up the jinns. The jinns were incarnate entities that seek to latch on themselves to human beings to give them psychic powers in exchange for either blood from the body, use of the body, or offsprings from the body, or discharges from the body. Now, the jinn will also do this. If he does something for you, he challenges your life. And you have to be on your guard if you can block him so that he doesn't take your life. Yeah, because you are using him as a slave.
Then how about here?
Well, all right. You read in the other biography of the yogi of Afzal Khan.
Right.
Who was he calling on?
Hazrat.
Well, who do you think Hazrat was? He was a jinn.
Hazrat was nice, though, wasn't he?
You think so?
Did the Asmodeus, when
Solomon
was tricked by Asmodeus, Asmodeus, I think, was giving him a ring, and he picked him up, blew him, and
gave him the ring. Yes. Asmodeus, you see, Solomon was able to beat Asmodeus by using Lucifuge Rufocale. He defeated Asmodeus by using Lucifuge Rufocale. What did Solomon pray for when he was praying?
Wisdom and understanding.
Who gave him his wisdom and his understanding? Lucifuge Rufocale. Not God. God didn't give Solomon wisdom. Lucifuge Rufocale is the entity that gave him wisdom, providing Solomon will worship him at the end of the 12th year. And Solomon agreed. He made a pact with Lucifuge Rufocale for the wisdom to govern all the entities of the lower realm. Therefore, Solomon wrote his book, The Greater and the Lesser Keys of Solomon. And in these keys, he designed the seal of Solomon to control the entity world. Now, when he had the wisdom, after serving Lucifuge Rufocale for 11 years, he got all the wealth of the gold from the gnomes. And the elementals brought the gold up, already pre-cut. The temple was already built in those 11 years by entity forces. So at the 12th year, Solomon pulled a switch on him and went into sackcloth and meditating and said, no man worship Lucifuge Rufocale but God. And that is how he defeated Lucifuge Rufocale. But Lucifuge Rufocale defeated Asmodeus because Asmodeus was a subsidiary entity force that was governed by Lucifuge Rufocale. He defeated what you would call now Yasat Matkal.
Negative force.
the negative force. In other words, he broke the time cycle in his own development by building a psychotron, which is the seal of Solomon.
It is a
psychotron. It's a double pyramid standing upon itself. One pyramid this way and another one this way. But see, Solomon knew this. And Solomon did not arrive at the fifth level, he arrived at the fourth level. The reason why he arrived at the fourth level, because he was trapped by lust. You see, Solomon was married to 363 wives. Well, the thing is, he married them. Don't get me wrong. Solomon didn't, when I said his lust for life, he married on every plateau of every level he went up. He married the various maidens of the Parizads and all the levels that going up on his way to Sach Khand.
What is a Parizad? You look at me like I'm supposed to know. I've never heard of that.
The word comes from paradise, Parizad. The maidens of Parizad are the nymphs that live in the gate around the gates of paradise. They are the ones who attract you in your night and cause you to have nocturnal emissions and drain your system out. And the male human body is drained at night by the maidens of Parizad. So he did not want to be drained at night in dreamland. So he, instead of being drained or submitting to, what you call it, the flirtations of the maids of Parizad, he married them. Now, as he married the maidens of Parizad, he impregnated them, so he had children in Parizad. Your Bible ain't got nothing, so don't worry. You have to read Solomon.
The Bible says all this?
I said your Bible don't have it, so don't worry, you're not going to find it in your Bible. You have to go and read Solomon. There are books that Solomon wrote that is not permitted to be published. It was taken out of your Bible.
Can they be found?
They're called the 10 lost books of the Bible. Or the 10 suppressed books, you want to call it. Pope Irene was the man who cut out the books from the Bible that dealt with all the mystic life, all the psychic life, all the reincarnation. But he could not cut it out of the New Testament.
Where is this book?
It's a part of the Apocrypha, but it's not all in there.
Are there any places in the United States where these books exist?
I don't know. I haven't seen them in the United States. I've seen them in another country. My friend, when I was those were the first books I had to read. The 10 lost books of the Bible. To study to be a priest in the Catholic Church, you have to learn a lot about black magic before you can be a priest.
And the priest is aware of these books and has seen
them? Yes, but he's not supposed to say anything.
They don't. Like that.
How is the Church going to fight the war against witchcraft, magic, and all these cultisms that exist that bleed the individual and live off of blood and cannibalism, unless they know what is going on? You think the Church sends out the missionaries to the other countries just to be missionaries? That's the camouflage. They send them to study their beliefs so they know how to attack them. They are in a relentless war for Christ. And they have no let up, no quarter. That's why you will never get the Pope to grant you birth control. They are not for no idea dealing with lessening or weakening the human soul.
They allow priests to marry, didn't they?
They don't allow priests to marry. They have to leave the Church. Huh?
Did they use it many years ago?
No.
Why did they pass all this book?
Because as human beings, you are not going to become Christian. You're going to become more churchianistic because you're going to delay your studies. You see, the commune life is not a new thing to the Christian church. The Christian church had a commune life, and they found out the difficulties of the commune life. There are those who come and sit down and do nothing and wait for others to do it. And the Pope, after a while, saw that there were many freeloaders hanging on. So you know what he did? He broke them all up with the nonsense about reincarnation and everything. He took it all out of their books and get them down to the science of living now. So therefore, there were no more books circulating, and only the priests were allowed to have them. Then the monks finally ended up custodians for it. And the only people who are now the actual custodians are the Jesuits. But they're dedicated.
If you go to the Jesuits, chances are you study something yourself.
That's if you can make it. They have the toughest discipline to crack you, that you can't make it. But because if you become a Jesuit and stick it to the end, you're a good one. It's designed as a military force. The Jesuit hermitage is designed as a military organization. Its whole principle is based on militarism. To crack you open in such a way that you really got to toe the line. So you're not going to find the books available outside of the Jesuits, and only other place is the Vatican, where the Pope himself has total custody for them. And the original scrolls of the R. So there are lots of books that you can never get.
So were you studying Jesuit priesthood?
The priest that I was studying, when the order that I was trying to belong to, was the Benedictine. See, the Benedictines were in South America at the time. It's not so easy to get into the Jesuits, nor to get into the Trappists. The Trappists. That's a different order altogether.
He said, he said he was silent for like 8 years the whole time he was in there. Just totally silent.
When you enter the monastery, three things you leave behind in the outside world: your ability to speak, your hair, and your dignity. You leave them outside. You don't have any inside. There is no talking, except when it's emergency by the prior or the abbot. There is no sense of parading. Every man is dressed the same. And every man gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning and does his 12 and a half hour day stretch. That's not including his prayer periods. He's got to do 12-hour straight stretch work. Now, that's only the Trappist. When you get to the Jesuit, it's a 16-hour shift. I had a friend of mine, he was a Jesuit. When he came out, he was a wreck.
A wreck? It didn't help him?
They dismissed him and sent him home because he was physically unfit to become a Jesuit. After 20 years.
Why? After 20 years they decided that he wasn't
no
good?
No, he was no good. He lived among the Crow Indians.
I bet he was disappointed.
Oh yes, he's not today now. He's not, he's an initiate too. And they told him at the end of 20 years he was totally unfit to become a Jesuit. He didn't have it.
Why did they go that long? 20 years is a long time.
If you think the priest could see him, how long does it take to become a Jesuit anyway?
Your whole life? You see, he had the problem you just discussed. He wants to know how long he become a Jesuit. He wants to know how long things are going to happen and have experiences and be a Jesus man, you know. He's going to go out and zap people. So after 20 years, he found out that he didn't have it. They showed him that it's not that, that he's got the wrong idea about being a Jesuit. It's rough. Well, I think we have our yoga exercise now.
I wanted to ask you one question.
Let's take a break, yeah?
I wanted to ask you a question.
Fall out to all faithful.
I thought we were in a safe area, now fall out.
Sorry, this is green smog in the form of money. Y'all are falling out.
Tonight we have a wonderful friend with us, Mr. Jack Hansen from California, who I've been very fortunate to have known for many years.
You fooled me. I thought he was from the North Pole. You burst my Christmas bubble.
Well, coming back to what we were discussing today, is there any questions? Yes?
These incomplete entities.
Right.
Are they still here?
Are they? We're doing them a favor.
By having children.
Are we doing them a favor?
Yes, we're doing them a favor by having children and raising our level of consciousness prior to the incoming of that entity into the body.
One sperm that makes it, and that body becomes a living soul that has already had previous experiences, right?
Yes.
Now, all the others, are they souls that have not yet had any experiences?
They've had experiences from previous lives, yes.
They have, yeah.
But the experiences may not synchronize with the desire pattern that you have at the moment. You see, if the desire pattern that you have at the moment of release before completion, that desire pattern may have some negative tendencies in it. Now, if it didn't come to completion, now it's still hanging in the atmosphere waiting. Now, if your personal life has changed after that release, and that you really sincerely want to make more progress on a spiritual path, then when you desire to have another release and it comes to completion, instead of attracting one of the entities now with the lowest desire pattern, you begin to attract one with the highest desire pattern. But remember, during that time you have released many of them. And each time you release without completion, whatever was the cause that brought release, that desire pattern is impregnated. So the one with the highest desire pattern would be the one that will be drawn in to come to completion. So your desire has a great deal to do.
So our desire is attracting souls,
yes,
from higher realms,
mm-hmm,
to us just by virtue of the desire.
Right. That is why the marriage vow is designed for the initiate to bring onto the earth plane newborn souls who will act as spiritual ushers to bring other souls back home from delusion. Do you remember the marriage vows when we repeat them? As we go over them in the wedding or ceremony, the bride and groom often makes a statement that they are joining their love to bring newborn souls into the world that will act as spiritual ushers to bring back other souls from delusion. So the more you, your desire pattern for a higher being to come into your married life, the greater would be that influx, and that would then make that individual act now at an early age to be spiritual and to want to bring back other people out of that mental dilemma. And they will actually start moving backward to the oneness of the spirit.
Bringing these entities before us, are we making a karmic involvement with them that later on we may have to meet?
No. By generating the desire to attract them magnetically by your love, that karmic debt is resolved for the ones that did not complete themselves with lower vibrations. You help to cancel out the unfinished debt. So you see, it is the reason why your scripture says we should not abort or spill the seed, because we are liable for that condition. Now if we are liable, then we must make restitution. We must correct it. That's what is karma. The karma is that you sow it, you reap it, you correct it. Now, masters don't correct your karma for you. They only adjust the weight that you carry it better. In other words, the impact is adjusted for you by the grace of the master. But nevertheless, you're the one who has to reap it. You're the one who has to work it out. You're the one who got to face it. Now, if you accept that you can correct it and you will correct it, then you automatically release the patterns from the entities that you have released into the atmosphere and caused them now to resolve themselves. You see? So we have a hand in altering the destiny, not the fate. There's no such thing as fate. The destiny of the unfinished entity in the new body form. We have a hand in that. Now, remember this, we are married, and the wife will say, I like to have 2 children. And the husband says, I don't want no children right now. So these are conflicting desires. And we may have the act of procreation not coming to completion. Yet the act is carried on with these 2 latent desires. Do you follow? The wife is thinking of having 2, and the husband is thinking of having none. Yet the act is never completed. So these desire forces are locked into the entity that remain hanging in the atmosphere for completion. Now, as many times as you repeat the process without bringing it to completion, that is as many entities left hanging in the atmosphere. Until you decide to come to completion, and in the meantime you can alter your consciousness by becoming spiritual in between time. That doesn't say you could not become spiritual. You might become spiritual and begin to resolve these mental conflicts and look at life a little different, more objective, more in the light of understanding your nature. Then this would cancel out a great deal of those entities with the lowest vibratory rate and pull in the ones with the higher vibratory rate. And therefore that child will come in having now qualities that you are looking for. So we again can attract those spiritual entities into our lives by raising our desire nature.
I didn't hear the last part of
lecture at noon, but every time you have a relationship that chalks one up, an entity hanging there in the air, supposedly coming in?
Yes.
It does, huh? Hey, hey.
Stop bragging.
Stop bragging. Okay.
All right. Now, here is an interesting observation. A man and a woman starts out not really spiritual as yet. They're just getting a glimmer of spiritual life, and they have a child. And the child would seem to have some indication of brightness, you know, sharpness. As they become more spiritual, more in tune, the next child seems to be far more refined in quality as it comes in. Now, prior to the first two children, you might just have glimmers in your eyes and you may just have unfinished relationships without bringing it to completion. These